Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
This meeting is being recorded.
Hello and welcome to another episode of My Property World. We're talking cautious reality with Adam Lawrence. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me again, Will.
So Adam is a property entrepreneur, over 500 property purchases under his belt. He's a co-founder of Partners in Property, which you can look up at partners-property.com. And we're going to be talking both macroeconomics in a property context and microeconomics in terms of what you should be doing and how you should be thinking as a property investor, or ways of considering to think. So Adam, we're going to start off in the macro. Central bank, what's going on at the moment?
So something's been playing on my mind, Will, and I've mentioned it over previous podcasts sort of in passing, but I think it's more serious and I think it needs a bigger slot on this piece and in everybody's minds. So every quarter, when the Bank of England meet every 6 weeks, generally speaking, that's been slightly disrupted in the latter half of this year by the passing of Her Majesty the Queen, apart from anything else, but generally meet every 6 weeks, but they meet 8 times a year. So avid mathematicians will know there's only 6 times 8 is 48. So there's a bit of give around Christmas time and all the rest of it, right? There's a bit of slack in the system. The meeting dates are generally fairly deliberately chosen because a good central bank wants to give as much notice to the markets and the businesses and the individuals in the economy as it can. A good central bank runs very transparently, which it generally does at a certain level. But then all governmental organisations have levels within levels, of course. And this whole thing was prompted by when Mr. Sunak was enshrined as Prime Minister this week. He made a statement which was very contrary to the way that both Boris Johnson and Liz Truss have run their statements over the recent days, weeks, months and years. Because both Truss and Johnson were very big fans of what's called boosterism. Now, boosterism is where, regardless of reality, you say how great everything is. So it's a bit different from having a sort of rosy disposition and trying to make the best of everything. It's sometimes outright lying. It's like, so we're in the middle of a thunderstorm. It's like standing there without an umbrella and going, hey, don't worry about it, guys. It's not raining. Be positive, right. You know. It's going to stop in 30 seconds. Doesn't matter. It's not going to matter, even when it's not, you know. And Sunak decided to go for a bit of brutal reality instead. And despite the significant calming effect that he's had on the markets, which we'll go into shortly, he decided to use the words, Britain is facing a profound economic crisis. Now, you could say that's the complete opposite of boosterism, right? Or you could think, right, why has he chosen to do that? Is that likely to be gamesmanship? It would seem strange if it is to me. I can't fathom a gamesmanship style angle to that. So that was lurking in my mind this week. And I thought back to going back to the central bank, Bank of England, when they have of their 8 meetings a year, 4 of those are accompanied by the publication of a report. So there's a quarterly inflation report, the bank calls it, but now they call it the monetary policy report because they appreciate that it goes beyond just inflation, right? So let's just track back. Central bank has a mandate to control inflation by the central government. That's their only really clearly official mandate with a numerical target, 2%. Bit of a joke at the moment for anybody listening, because inflation is 10% and real world inflation being faced by people at the bottom of society, or people who are in the construction industry or the development industry, has been more like 20 to 40% over the last year. So that's worth bearing in mind. And every time there's a quarterly report, there are a number of events around the country where representatives from the bank will go out and distribute that information amongst business communities, academic institutions, and the like. So Will, very well versed in my second and most loved alma mater of Warwick University, the mighty Warwick University of Coventry. And for whatever reason...
Is that near Watford somewhere?
Watford Gap Services isn't that far away, actually. That's not as strange as it sounds, but it's definitely north of the Gap. They hold an event quarterly, and they invite their brightest and best alumni along, and they also invite me. So I go along to those, and I use those events to take in information, network with people who are in a whole variety of industries, and I use them as a springboard to ask questions to the Bank of England directly. And this time round, which was this month, I went to ask a specific question. Well, it was actually just at the end of September the meeting was. A specific question about the stress test that the bank produces. So just to give a little bit of colour around that, the bank produces a stress test once a year, and that stress test is kind of a 2008 hangover thing. And the idea of the stress test is to say, under extremely stressful conditions in the economy,
what might happen?
What happens specifically to the banks, the retail and commercial banks, right? So it's not addressing the general population, because ultimately, that is the remit of the central government, right? Realistically, yeah? fiscal policy has much more, fiscal as in government set tax and spending policy, has much more of a direct impact on the individuals and the businesses, right, than monetary policy does, right? So the bank is taking responsibility, because one of the things it does in its broader mandate is it has responsibility for being involved with the regulation of the banks alongside the PRA, Prudential Risk Authority, and the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, right? So, for example, it sets rules like the stress test for mortgages in buy-to-let, because one of the things the former governor, Mark Carney, was quite concerned about was that the investor market might act much more quickly than the retail market in housing and sell properties if certain things happened, right? Although there wasn't much evidence of that happening actually after 2008. There was plenty of repossession, of course, but there wasn't that much evidence of that happening. But nonetheless, that was his concern. So they set what are actually some pretty lax guidelines, really, in my opinion, around interest rate coverage and stuff like that. But they do this annual stress test every year. It's 2008 hangover. What's changed massively since 2008, apart from anything else, is the amount of capital that the banks need to keep on hand in order to ensure they have liquidity if there's a run on the bank, so they can't fractionalize as much as they used to in the past. So their activities are somewhat curtailed in a sensible ratio, right? So that stress test was published. And on the day of the meeting that I attended, which was a week or so after the Monetary Policy Committee meeting, that was just about when things were starting to go really, really interesting. So the mini budget had been announced. The markets were already very volatile and they were concerned about Ms. Truss's premiership. They weren't sure she was the right person for the job. And the chat that had been coming out of her mouth for months started to get very real, right? So I asked a question, and that question was, in the stress test, the Bank of England set a number of scenarios, and then what they're saying is, how would the banks fare if this scenario came together, right? And the scenarios that they set were, number one, the housing, in terms of relevance to people, listeners of this podcast, number one, the housing market to go down 31%, right? So I need to emphasize, Will, this is a stress test. This is not a prediction, right? Now, you know, I'm a big fan of economic history and data. If you go back to 2008, 2009, from the top of the curve to the bottom, the drop of transacted properties in terms of price on average, and we've discussed many times how dangerous averages can be, but nevertheless, on average, was a 15.5% drop, right? So 31% is double the previous maximum drawdown in a short space of time in the housing market. I would support that as a very good stress test scenario. And I would suggest it would be phenomenally unlikely for us to go to 31%. And there'd be no merit in going beyond 31% down. Now, that's what you want from a good stress test, right? The UK GDP contracts by 5%. So again, UK GDP contraction peak to trough 2008 to 2009-10 was about 2.5%. And that's big. You know, I know it doesn't sound like a lot in percentage terms, but it's big.
And it's significant when you consider what the projected rate of growth at the preceding period is. So it's probably about 5% if you ask me to guess.
You're exactly right. So the preceding growth was
predicted. And all of the projected incomes, tax revenues, the et cetera.
All the things that come along with that. Yeah, absolutely. So you're going from a positive 2.5 to a negative 2.5. So it is a 5% drop. So again, the double max drawdown rule, which is the right way to do it in these situations. It's a bit crude. I'm sure there's more statistical nuances to that, but I call it the double max drawdown rule. The stress test allowed for a GDP contraction of 5%. Right now, if you went back to COVID, there was a 25% contraction in GDP, but nobody even remembers that it was a recession because there was so much stimulus and government support, right? So you have to leave that out of the figures. It is just anomalous. So again, the 5% drop in GDP looks sensible. Right? Unemployment goes to 8.5, they said. Now, unemployment's currently 3.6. It's super, super low. Now, there are a number of problems with unemployment as a figure, right? We'll rattle through a few just quickly. Number one, IR35 legislation is meaning that contractors have had to go on to PAYE and is therefore over-declaring employment compared to the last 5 or 10 years, because contractors who were on...
You're not comparing apples with apples there.
Well, you are moving them from one place to another.
There's a couple of extra Granny Smiths in with the pink ladies.
I'm just concerned that that has an impact on the integrity of the figures, right? Number two, employed, you might work 4 hours a week, right? Part-time and full-time needs consideration, yeah? Number three, it's only measuring people who are in the market for a job. And this is really the big one, right? So why would you be out? Why would you be between 16 and it's still, and you know, perversely, the way statistics work, the ONS really needs to sort this out. Unemployment measures between 16 and 65 year olds. That's fundamentally stupid because these days, up to 18, you're required to be in full-time education. And then you can't retire till 67. So it's measuring the wrong people, but never mind, right? At the margin. So you've got three real big reasons to be out of the sample within that age range. Number one, you've absolutely crushed it to bits. You've done your bid. You worked in the city till you burned out or whatever. You're retired. Yeah. You're not in the market for a job, right? You're outside of that. You might still do some work, but you're not in the market for a job, right? Number two, and this has been the biggie since COVID, long-term sickness, right? So we've got a much worse on paper long-term sickness problem with long COVID than a lot of other countries. And there could be a number of reasons for that. If you read the right-wing press, they'll tell you it's because everybody's lazy and they're swinging the leg. If you read the left-wing press, they'll tell you it's because Mr. Johnson didn't control COVID enough and too many people had it and we had worse variants and we have worse weather and we're all fatter and all the other problems that the UK has, right? Leaving out the United States for that purpose of that comparison, obviously. And then the third element to that, you're in full-time education, right? And that in aggregate comes together at the moment to about 550,000 people fewer being in the labour market right now for a job looking, yeah, than there were 3 years ago. So before the pandemic, right? So we've got 550,000 people fewer. The population has still grown, yeah? So it's a bigger problem than 550,000, if you see what I mean. And you've got all these opportunities. The job vacancies are still off the historical chart. They've taken a little turn down in previous months, but they're still off the chart. Like, as in, you know, a long-term number might have been 500,000 to 600,000. We've been knocking in at the sort of 1.1 to 1.3 million. So we've been double the maximum ever. Well, not the maximum, the general trend line over the last few years, sorry. Which is obviously a massive difference. So all of that leads to very low unemployment. Unemployment 3.6. In the bank stress test, 8.5. So a really, really significant departure from today's situation, right? I'm fine with all of those. I think they're deeply correct in terms of what a stress test needs to do, right? There's a far, far fewer than 1% chance of that scenario actually occurring, yeah? But this is the point of the stress test. It's dealing with the sky is falling, are the banks bust? And the real question, do the government need to bail them out again? That's the real question that it's answering, right? And the answer is no, which is good for the government and therefore the taxpayer, right? But the stress test considers the bank rate going to 6% in early 2023 and then dropping back to about 3.5, yeah? Put that into context with all of my last comments. Now, when I went to the meeting, the market prediction for the base rate in early 2023 was 6%, right? And if you looked at the market curve predicting base, it had gone up and up and up and up and up over the course of the year. So it seemed to me a sensible and fair question to ask that within the backdrop that all of the other metrics in the stress test seem robust, very robust, which you would expect.
Which very loosely twice what the worst in recent history has been.
Unemployment nearly thrice, you know, all on board with all of that. However, the base rate side of it, which is the key input to the model, right? The absolutely key input, yeah? The base rate stress isn't high enough. Surely it's not high enough, right? And I've never been treated like such a naughty school child since the last time I was at school. Because these meetings are about good communication, transparency, informing people who are decision makers at a micro level in the economy, people like me who might be communicating it to people who are listening. It's important that they're like that. And the guy stopped, the Bank of England rep just stopped, and he said, the Monetary Policy Committee are very comfortable that 6% is more than enough for the stress test.
I just got an image of the People's Republic of China five-yearly conference, the Communist Party conference, and the former leader being walked out by a security guard before he got to ask that type of question.
Well, that's the beauty of living in the UK.
Where is the security guard in this one?
Annoying though I might be, I was allowed to ask the question. But obviously, you know, in reality, apart from, you know, a bit of initial shock, really, because I've never seen that. It was a hostile is the wrong word, but the level at which I was cut down was so very aggressive. And I thought, right, what does that mean? Right? What does that mean? Now, I'm back to Mr. Sunak's profound economic crisis statement, yeah? He knew the situation when he was in number 11. He's got the gig. He's the big dog now. And the problems that he thought he was going to have when Johnson was in charge are bigger, right? They're bigger because some bloody idiot has come in and spooked the global markets against the UK. So...
I have a lot of learned economically literate friends from around the world, and they've looked on with somewhere between horror and amusement with what's gone on in the UK in the last couple of months.
Sad but true. One
of them had a great sort of view about what needs to happen. And a huge element, and it ties in the central bank versus the government. They should be acting as one, largely.
Absolutely.
And in a nutshell, this friend pointed out that we're spending 6 or 7% more than we're producing, or in terms of as an economy, and that. That is okay if it's on future growth, but I don't see, and it becomes justifiable if you're in a developing economy to be borrowing more than you're creating today, because you know that you're going to be getting 7, 8, 10% growth over the next 2 or 3 years as a result of that borrowing. But
I sort of disagree with that, but that would take us on a very long tangent that I think will knock us off the goal of this current podcast. I'm very happy to do that, but another time, I think we'll. But just finishing the central bank point. So what did the guy mean by saying it so brusquely to me when he answered my question? And then, of course, my mind is working in the background thinking, okay, so he also seemed very confident. He believed what he was saying, right? And I thought, well, this is interesting because I don't see particular evidence that this is such a strong position for the bank, for the Monetary Policy Committee to take, right? So just do a quick economic history lesson. The last time the bank rate was really very volatile, And I'll leave out March 2009, where we dropped from 5.5 to 0.5 overnight. That was obviously significant, but it wasn't volatile because the patient flatlined and stayed on the table at 0.5% or so for, you know, 13 years, right? The last time we were very volatile, really, and I mean really volatile, was when Britain unexpectedly left the ERM, European Exchange Rate Mechanism, in the early 90s, in 1992. And people will often say they remember when the Bank of England put the rates up to 15% and their mortgage went to 18%. And I quite often get on my soapbox about this because that's not really what happened, right? What happened was one afternoon, the bank verbally said they were going to go up to 10% and then to 15%. And then the government, internal departments, the Treasury, etc. Because remember, the bank was still controlled by the government at that stage. It wasn't independent, yeah? Then someone went away and did the maths, which sounds a little bit like how Liz Truss used to run things, doesn't it? And said, do you know what? If we're at 15, then half the people in the country are going to lose their houses. Yeah, they're going to lose their houses because they won't be able to afford the mortgage rates. So they actually came out, and within 5 days, they'd cut the base rate. They never actually officially went to 15. And within five working days, or even five, it was 5 days, not even five working days, over the course of a weekend, they cut the base rate back to 8.875%. Now, that number is still intergalactically high in our current world, right? But my point is, it was said it was going to be 15, and within less than a week, it was nearly half 15 because the damage was so high. So what the bank, I think, know for sure is that if base did go to 6, right, if it went to 6, something would have to be done because so many people would be facing repossession. So that's where my mind sort of first leap was, right? And then I'm always, we talked a little bit before about the book Super Forecasting by Tetler. And if you want to be a good forecaster, there's not a lot of room for ego. There's not a lot of room for rest, to be honest. You need to be on top of it all the time. And I want to be a good forecaster, right? I want to be one of the best in the game. So I have to amend my forecast based on what they've said. But it strikes me that this year has been characterized by some strange things. If we went back to the 1st of January, I know that the Bank of England's intention was not to raise the rates very much this year. 0.25%, right? Why? Because the economy still needed that cheap money in order to limber, to move forward at a really limp rate of growth. Yeah. Then inflation really took off, particularly when Russia went into Ukraine, right? Energy price inflation, knock-on consequences. It meant that people like me who've been going on about inflation for the year before that were proven to be spectacularly right. But unless we actively predicted a hot war, then we were probably right for the wrong reasons. Yeah. And we were more right than we thought we were going to be to an extent, you know? So
the language of seduction from the central bank is what you're looking at, as well as what the numbers are saying today.
Sure. And they changed their tune, right? Because they've had to put the rates up because there's too much concern. The international community is forcing the rates up anyway because all the gilt yields are going up, all the bond yields are going up, all the resultant swap rates are going up. So if we just divert just briefly to that situation, right, the bond yields are the price that the government pays for the debt that they borrow, right? So international, UK-based pension funds, family offices, large investors, the safest bet in the game if you're interested in sterling and the UK pound is to buy government bonds, right? They were all saying, well, hold on a second, we can get the exchange rate looks weak because we can get better return in dollars because the Federal Reserve's putting their rates up. And if you don't act, the UK economy is going to be in trouble. That's going to see a downgrade of the credit rating. We want a better return on our money if we're going to lend it to the UK government. And to an extent, the bank's got to follow that a little bit. And the bank also believes that raising rates will calm inflation down. That's quite a complex argument, of which there are a few viewpoints. which I'm going to park to one side for the purposes of this for the moment. So the interest rate starts going up and we're already at 2.25, and the favoured outcome for next Thursday is that we go to 3% base. Unthinkable at the beginning of this year for the central bank. Unthinkable, but we're there, right? So what happened is one thing took a bigger priority, right? So as and when something else maybe takes priority over everybody losing their houses, not everybody, because it would never be everybody, it would be a fraction of the population, a meaningful fraction, and that would lead to a cascade of benefits, homelessness, you know, the local authority and central government pressure to sweep that up would be intergalactic.
Which are currently in crisis on those specific points.
Already in crisis, yeah, absolutely. It would be seriously problematic. Well, the hotel bills would run into the many, many billions, you know, a week, probably. So that's where my mind is at. And what can change for the central bank to have to deprioritize the ultimate control? They see 6% very clearly as a complete cap. Since Rishi has ascended to the, has been coronated as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party, the market now thinks base rate's going to be about 4.25 next year at the top, right? But the thing I can't stop asking myself, Will, is what if they're wrong? What if they're wrong? And what about if there's another upside shock event, right? What if Putin does this, that, or the other? What if there's a lot, there's a whole number of what ifs we could go into, right?
So, the whole around what's happening with China over the next year.
The stuff we were talking about.
It could be a boom or depression in China, and we don't know.
Just very briefly, I've shared a couple of graphs this week about the natural gas price and about the electricity price on socials. Right. My point was the prices have come back down an awfully long way, much lower than expected, much lower than the futures curves were predicting, right? Why? Because most of the European countries have done a smart thing and on the quiet-ish, filled up their reserves faster than they would have done, even though the price was higher, right? There's tankers in the ocean at the moment, people might have seen on the news, that are full of LNG, liquefied natural gas, that can't even dock anywhere because all the ports and all the infrastructure is full, right? So one of the things that happened this week is the next hour spot, which is the price that within the next hour, if you're going to sell the fuel on gas, went negative. But it wasn't really relevant because most of that that's being traded will be being done by futures contracts rather than by spot price. And the spot price isn't relevant if you can't dock because you can't unload the gas within the next hour, right? Because no one's got the capacity to take the storage on shore. But so it's a market anomaly rather than anything truly meaningful. But
the value of the tankers must be going through the roof.
The gas, well, the shipping magnates are not happy about this situation. You can imagine. But those boys tend to operate with a pretty big. They're swinging some pretty big bats, Will, because their working capital is in the many billions. You know, they're big, big players. So probably not as bad as when the Suez Canal was blocked those couple of years ago. Was it the Panama Canal? No, it was the Suez, wasn't it? So that's where the commodity prices are today. And one of the things that concerns me about today's world is we have this tendency, and markets have this short-termism inbuilt into them. And at individual micro level, we've got it built into us because our fingers, it seems these days, are built to scroll down screens like this, drinking in information that's been constructed by an algorithm to capture our attention, right?
Hold our eyes on the phone.
For microseconds or seconds at a time, shortening our attention spans, potentially hollowing out society to an extent if you're not careful, right?
And the thinking about this afternoon becomes long term.
Yeah, exactly right. So the thinking about the markets, we're looking at, you know, they're very short term anyway. People always joke, you know, the S&P 500 or the FTSE is about the next quarter's results, right? Whereas if you're trying to forecast and look at the game that we're in, where we're talking about property, investment and development, right? Even if we're developing, we're probably taking a 2 to 3 year time frame. Yeah. If we're developing to hold or if we're buying investment property, we should, I hope, be taking a 10 plus year time frame. Right. So what should be important to us? People like me who are looking at these long term things thinking, when the 30 year UK gilt was 5.1%, I'm just ruining the fact I haven't got my whole net worth in the bank today, so I could just go, I'll take that for the next 30 years on the UK government. That sounds okay. Because it's 30 years. And it was being based on someone in Premiership who was looking, who was being compared to a lettuce and a Chancellor who hung around for very just over a month. And then, you know, the machine got rid of both of them. That doesn't make sense. You can't 30 years based on 30 days. It's crazy, but it did happen.
And that short-term thinking point.
Yeah. So that's what concerns me, because now a lot of people are looking at the commodities prices, the futures has been knocked down a little bit on the back of this. The real big reason for this is actually the weather. So, you know, we've had across Europe, a lot of the heating has gone back off at the moment. We've had a mild spell, right? We're currently experiencing a pretty typical English autumn with a fair bit of rain, but the temperature's not bad. I was sitting outside yesterday after
20 degrees in London yesterday.
After Partners in Property Bristol yesterday, we were sitting outside on a terrace in Clifton, beautiful part of the world. And, you know, I was wondering if I was going to get sunburned. And it was the 28th of October, you know, it was phenomenal. 19, 20 degrees, you know, late afternoon, beautiful. So that's helpful. And that my point was that's saving the government billions of pounds because they're guaranteeing this. My point was not, oh, yay, the energy crisis is over. And to think that it is would be bloody nuts. If I was a commodities trader, right, I would be absolutely smashing into longer dated crude futures. And the price now for nat gas, you know, shorter dated futures contracts for nat gas and for electricity, because the market's overreacted and there's so much volatility. I wouldn't actually be smashing into them. I'd be using options, really, but that's outside the scope of this conversation. But I'm not doing that. I'm not actively trading. I've got enough on my plate without actively trading the commodities markets, right? And I'm not a commodities trader, so I should be bloody staying away from it. But there's still a huge amount of volatility to come down the pipe. We talked last week at length about China and the amount of energy demand there will be when the beast finally roars back into full action. That's just one point around. What about the supply issues if Putin halves the amount of oil that he sends out to the world? It's a gigantic, gigantic issue, right? What if he, you know, Ukraine has lost 40% of its electricity generation because they've bombed and taken out the infrastructure. 40%. I mean, we can't fathom that. What's interesting is the markets didn't think Europe would be able to save 15% of their consumption. But they were able to, because when you go from a society where you can turn the lights on or the heating on without worrying too much about it, to a society where cost of living pressures are meaning that people are genuinely really worried about this stuff. Do you know what, Will? I'm turning the lights off more, right? And in the nicest possible way, I can afford to pay the bills, right? So I know that other people are doing the same thing. And I'm sure that's
just summarizing in a sense or two, your 3 points, the central bank, the gilt swap rates, and short-term.
Yeah. So the outcome of all of this and what needs to be done around it, I'm still very concerned there's an upside risk to the base rate. And I'm concerned, I'm even more concerned now, because I'm worried that our Central Bank Monetary Policy Committee are understating it, right? I'm also concerned on the back of the statement I was talking about, that there are a whole load of bombs in the pipeline and we don't know what they are. One of them was leveraged liability-driven investment for pension funds, right? And that nearly blew up, but the bank stepped in with great skill in the right time and did the right thing, right? There are maybe 20 other sticks of dynamite along the track. We don't know where they are and whether the train is going to depress the track enough to make them go off. The bank and Rishi do know where they are, and that's why he uses the words profound economic crisis, yeah? And that's a concern. Now, the point here is not to say, I know what's going to happen to the base. I'm not saying that. I'm saying still at today's levels, right? Rishi's come in and the five-year swap rate has gone from 5% to 4%. The five-year swap is the most relevant number for property investors. Now, that 4% means that it's possible for a lender to knock some money out at, say, 5.5% on a five-year fix, still make a margin. They're going to need to charge a bigger fee to make an acceptable margin for them. But you might see 3 or 4% fee products with a 5.5% fixed rate. And for lots of people in buy-to-let, that will be sufficient, yeah? That rate isn't out there today. Let's just be clear about that. I am theorizing that within the next 30 to 60 days, that rate will be there, yeah? As and when, if I'm right, that sort of rate comes about, 5.5, maybe 5.75, you know, something like that. If it stacks up, personally, I'll be taking it, right?
And so why would you be fixing soon as a summary?
And I'm going to be checking. I'm checking the rates daily. I'm checking the service levels of the lenders daily, because if they start to improve, it means the lenders are getting quieter, which means the products they issue are going to get better, right? And when you take a rate, Will, bear in mind, your broker gets a decision in principle for you that lasts 30 days. So there's an option for you to take that rate for 30 days. Then if you pay for the admin fee, the booking fee, whatever, and the valuation, you've then got about 2 months before all of that is organized and back in. You've then got an offer, which then is 3 more months before you have to complete that offer. So the process is at least 6 months if you want it to be. And this year, the service levels around the whole of the industry have been so crap. It's been more like 10, 12 months to get some of these things done, right? So if I'm wrong and base hits 4 and starts to come back down, you don't need to complete that loan. A lot of the lenders will let you switch onto the cheaper product during the process, which is very, very kind of them, obviously, right? So, but if I'm right, and something or a black swan sails in, you know, on the back of an extremely fragile situation already, like you were saying about housing, for example, if I'm right, and something like that does happen, then you're massively protected because you're in that process. And if the difference between the long-term rates, in my mind, are not over the next 5 years going back below 4 or even 4.5%. And I'm talking about limited company five-year fixes, because that's what's relevant to me and most of the people listening to this, right? So if they're not going below that, and I'm stating that with extreme confidence, right, Will? If they do go below that, something very, very, very bad has gone on. And a lot of you might be struggling to hold on to your assets, right? So I take that sentence very seriously, right? So if the downside is 1 or 1.5% that you might have saved if you didn't listen to this, yeah? What's the upside risk that you're protecting against? Well, we've already seen rates out there in the ether last month when things were very wonky 8.99 and things like that. Now, 8.99, most people are losing money or putting money in to assets. And if the rates stay anywhere near that, the first time buyer market collapses, the investment market collapses.
It's a fairly simple equation. If you want to be in a position where you can pay the bank out of the cash flow, you've got to have a net yield before finance of above the interest rate, and ideally substantially above it. And the higher that interest rate, the more money you're going to have to be taking out of a property on a monthly basis.
That's exactly right, Will. That's exactly right. So, but we've discussed before about how people can be looking at lower loan to values because they've got, you know, what's another good reason for getting a fix now? Yeah. We're getting valuations dropping in on stuff that are what we're asking for. Now, we ask for punchy stuff because we know if we go low, the surveyor pretty much never values it up. Right. So why not ask? Why not ask for a fair number? Also, there's been such a lag between some of these applications and the surveyor actually getting out to them that what we've asked for is now looks conservative rather than punchy. Because what's dropping in, remember, this is about lagging versus leading indicators, right? The lagging indicator, the transactions that have dropped onto the land reg that are now available to everybody in, say, August 2022. Were deals that were agreed in April 2022 as a rule, plus or minus a month or two, yeah? The majority of them. The market was still very buoyant and the rates were still very low, right? So this is why housing tends to operate on a more like a 18-month to two-year cycle behind what is actually happening. And that's part of people's concerns with the rising of the interest rates. But that's another.
And so the first concern of people generally is to protect their existing assets within their portfolio.
That's absolutely right. And that Mike Kovacs point from Rod's recent broadcast on that is an absolutely critical one. You know, so communicating to people how you protect your current asset. And I'll give you another reason to do that, Will, as well, right? How much time and headspace do you want to spend on what the interest rate is on that one or three or 10 difficult ones in your portfolio that are dropping off over the next however long, yeah? How much? Not very much, I would argue, because you need to be agile. You need to be working on your asset management, raising rents, using property to create more cash flow, whether it's layering HMO, whether it's doing SA, whether it's doing something else, you need to be, where it's going on to a commercial lease with a social housing provider, maybe ideally with an inflation linked clause into there or whatever, right? That's what you need to be working on. And then you need to be working on new deals. And what sort of new deals? We have seen a more than tenfold increase in leads that are coming across our email inboxes and our desks in my group over the last 3 weeks. Now, that might calm down again because Rishi has steadied the ship a little bit, right? But we've agreed a couple of things. We're looking at a couple of things, but all the stuff we're looking at has got healthy cash flow because that's what you need at the moment. So if we buy it and things do go a bit wrong, we can get out of this stuff at 7% fixed rate. If that's what we need to do, a lot of this stuff is cash flowing if it's on a bridge, right? So we're making ourselves bulletproof from what's coming. And all of the stuff we're buying has always got asset management opportunities anyway, without as a base level, right? So even if fixing at 5.79 or whatever leaves you with pretty much no cash flow in some of those assets, hopefully you've got other assets you've already fixed or aren't going to drop off their fixed rate mortgages for a while, or you're going to need to asset manage them aggressively, as I've just been saying, realistically, and or you're going to need to park that up and go and squeeze some of your human capital out and go and get a job or a consulting gig or whatever you need to do in order to bring the bucks in. Because at the moment, the labour market's tight and you might be surprised at the sort of money you can command for doing something that years ago used to be 300 quid a day that's now 600 quid a day. you know, might be very, very possible. So that's all worth bearing in mind. And I think that that is really how people listening to this can try and get through and not what's going to happen next year, because a tempted super forecaster that I am, I can't tell you, right? What I can tell you is insuring yourself against risk at the moment, upside risk that could send you broke, is the smartest thing you could possibly do, right?
And that word risk is essentially around the destruction of capital. What portion of your money in can be burnt?
I mean,
and what is the likelihood of that happening given basic changes?
I've been involved in 3 distressed company purchases or prospective purchases within the last 30 days, Will, right? And all of those are potential turnaround situations that need, well, no, two of them are turnaround situations, which need differing levels of skill, capital, focus, streamlining in order to become good businesses, right? They're all doable. Now, I've not really been fishing for that stuff that's come across my desk, yeah? That will be happening all over the place, all around the country. But all of those have got potential for good cash flow, right? The trading businesses, there's not loads and loads of money that needs to go into them, right? And that money can come out relatively quickly. They're also quite staple and stable in what they're doing, because they're either asset-backed or property services-related companies, right? Because that's my gig, right? So there's tons of that stuff out there at the moment, and there'll be tons more. And, you know, stressed and distressed are not all going to get saved. How many people have got their head in the sand, not looking for this stuff? Why am I looking at it? Because if it bolsters the group cash flow next year by a 6 or 7 figure sum, I think that's a pretty smart thing to be doing right now. And for everybody, if you could add 10K, let alone 50K, to your cash flow next year, that would be one of the smartest things you could do. So start with that premise and work out how you're going to do it.
So benchmarking.
Yeah, we've got to talk about that again. So one of the things that you it's you against yourself in this situation, right? So there'll be loads of people who didn't get the forms in time, weren't ready to transact. The broker talked them out of it. Everybody said, why pay the early repayment charge, right? So they didn't do it. And now they're a bit stuck because they might be on a variable rate or they might be facing a 6.79 or whatever, right? Forget what's happened in the past 9 months. You know, if you haven't fixed them, it is what it is. It's today. Don't look back at yesterday and say, if only, if only, if only. If it didn't happen, there's no point wasting time.
Where we stand.
There's no point wasting time blaming yourself, blaming your broker, blaming anybody. Blame is a waste of time, right? You can address that after the event, right? The event now is get bloody application in when you see a rate that is acceptable to you, and accept as well. You might move around a little bit. The brokers are going to hate me for saying this, but you've got to do the best for your own investment portfolio. You know, take a dip on a rate. Maybe don't go through with it if it looks like, you know, read, have a look at the swap rates, the 5-year swap rates. Have a look at the movement in the curve. Read the financial headlines, right? Act accordingly. Remember that the products are going to lag behind the swap rate. The move downwards from 5 to 4 in the last week or so has all been, you know, oh God, is Johnson coming back? Please tell us Johnson isn't coming back. Or is it going to be Penny Mordaunt? We don't really know too much about her economic intentions. We just know they can't be worse than Liz Truss's, because quite literally, my 11-year-old son would be a better prime minister than Liz Truss in terms of his economic understanding, right? So that's all out of the way, and there's a lot of calm. How long does it take for that to turn?
We have a policy of not bayoneting the dead on this show, please, Adam.
I'm afraid that head is going to be on the spike for some time, Will. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not letting up on that one. That's not negotiable, my friend. So don't benchmark against what you could have done last week, last year, last 6 months.
What the guy down the road is doing.
Don't benchmark against what you did. Look, if you fixed your home mortgage at 1.3% early this year, I'm very happy for you. Stop patting yourself on the back about it. It's done. You've got a great situation to make hay from over the next few years. Remember that when you come back to that mortgage in 2027 or whatever, it ain't going to be 1.3. So start planning your lifestyle accordingly, unless you've already got the money raining down from the heavens, of course, and you're listening to this on a desert island laughing while you're sipping pina coladas on the beach or whatever, right? Don't benchmark against other people on what's already happened. Make good decisions for today.
Over optimism.
So I'm still a little concerned about the number of people I hear saying, well, the rates are going to go up and they're going to come back down. It's like, okay, time out. How high? For how long? When are they coming back down? And what are they coming back down to? Because I currently believe the terminal base rate is probably more close to 3 to 3.5% at the moment as a steady state base rate. Now, in a calm economy, where that might also be the 5-year gilt, 3%, 3.5%, let's say maybe even a bit lower. 5-year swap might be at 3 to 3.5. That sees products at and around the sort of 5% level, right? That would be a nice, well, any sort of steady state would be nice at the moment, Will. But that's probably where things are going to. So if you're worried, if things don't stack up at 5% mortgage rates, you've got to ask yourself why they don't stack up. Don't just sit there thinking, rates are going to come back down. Because like I said, if they come back down to near zero, it means we've had another bloody economic meltdown, mate. And this one would be big, would be big. Now, I don't think it's going to happen. And I'm much more, if you said, what's the chance of it going up to 6%, the base rate, versus the chance of it going to 0.1 again, it's vastly more likely that it would go to 6% than to 0.1. Vastly more likely, right?
Can I just finish off with a simple question? Are you and the boys buying property at the moment?
We've agreed we're buying property and we're buying businesses, Will. You know, we've got more active...
So that's a yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, right. So anyone listening, it's not doom and gloom if you've got the right deals. Adam Lawrence, always a pleasure. Look at Adam G. Lawrence on LinkedIn. I'm Will Mallard. This is My Property World podcast.
Thanks, Will. Thanks for having me again. Great stuff.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.